I think you can, sounds like an oversimplification, but I think it's true that you can divide the Christian body into fundamentalists and non-fundamentalist believers. Fortunately, the Pope recently said that fundamentalism in any sort, Islamic, capitalist, whatever, was a kind of disease. And if anybody's trying to engage a fundamentalist Christian on the subject of whatever, you'll find how intractable they are, because they start from a starting point that is insupportable historically and then argue vigorously from that point. But the problem with fundamentalist thought is that it is totally ahistorical. It does not take into account that these texts are 2,000 years old or better. They come from a time and a culture in many ways radically alien from ours. I mean, this is a Semitic world. It's not the Western world of Aristotle and Plato and Du Bois. There are no girls, unfortunately. And this is important when you listen to these readings today, and when I tried to prepare something to say about them, because I think they address or speak to what I would call a kind of religious primitivism. What do I mean by that? Well, we have in this passage from the Hebrew, God as a big parent with a big paddle in her hand, ready to swat people down if they don't toe the line. And that's the kind of God I grew up with, as a matter of fact. Manifest in Sister Christella, and Sister Patrona, and Sister Carmeline, and Sister Mary Bernard, and my pastors. God is not some big parent in the sky. And all you have to do is read the book of Job, which is fairly late, which totally discounts this view of things, that God is there looking for my missteps so she can bang me on the head. I've said over and over again in a moment of rare insight in my life, God neither punishes nor rewards. What does God do then? God does what God always does. He lets be. She lets be. So if a person is going to mess up their life, the consequences get spelled out historically in their life. In other words, God is not there as some kind of external form regulating, ordering, demanding all kinds of right behavior. God just says, listen, you guys, you're free. You do what you want to do and take the consequences. If you choose not to love, that's hell. Hell is existing in a state of lovelessness. It's not a place with fire and pitchfork and demons with horns. It's a condition of lovelessness. So if you choose in your life to be unloving, the consequences of that are simply the spelling out of the choices that you have made. If you choose to be faithful, to try to seek God, to love, the consequences flow from that position as well. So that if I love now, God, in her mercy, will sustain that existence somehow, mysteriously, after death, about which we know virtually nothing, of course. No clouds, harps, angels singing, none of that nonsense. And this is especially important, I think, when we read this troubling, at least it's troubling to me, passage from Luke. I mean, what Luke wants to say is what the first reading wants to say, is that God is open to everybody. There are no privileged people. The chosen people are chosen only to be, as the scripture says, a light of revelation to the Gentiles. It does not privilege them in any way other than that. You are my agents in the world. You're supposed to be my agents in the world. Okay? So what about hell? Again, God does not do magic on us by planting ideas in our head that are totally incompatible with our cultural historical moment. There are no innate ideas, pace Plato. God just says, you know, here we are, I'm letting you be, you make your choices. And is there at least an abstract possibility that a person could die in a totally unloving state? Yeah, I said that's an abstract possibility. Yes, that is possible. And that's hell. But does hell exist? I don't know. I rather doubt it. Greek Catholics have a belief, if I can remember, it's a huge Greek word, kata encephalias or something like that, where everybody's going to be saved. That's not the word, by the way. I have to look it up. Big, long, hairy Greek word. Where ultimately everybody is going to be redeemed. Everybody's going to be saved. So this means Mao Zedong, Joseph Stalin, Hitler, Caligula, Domitian, every monster that's ever lived on the face of the earth. How is God going to do it? That's not my business. That's God's business. So when Jesus is talking about the people outside, he was a man of his time. They believed in hell. The Jews believed in hell. They borrowed it, by the way, from somebody else. It's not an innately Jewish idea. So they borrowed it from somebody else, probably the Greeks. But does hell exist? Again, as I say, as an abstract possibility, it does. What? That condition of unlovingness to the end, to the bitter end of one's life, where one resists the call of love. Now, who does that? I don't know. Hitler even loved his dog. He loved Eva Braun. He loved somebody. But I'm not making a case for Hitler. That's for God to do. And it's only at my risk that I play God and consign people to hell. So, Jesus was a first century Jew. First century Jews believed in hell. So what? He believed that earth was flat, too. If Jesus said, listen, folks, you got this all wrong. The earth was really this kind of pear-shaped, globular sort of form. The people say, you're crazy, you're blazes. No, God does not plant notions. And so, I don't know. This raises all kinds of big, hairy questions about the humanity of Jesus, about was there many contested theories. Was Jesus a real man? Yeah, we have to hang on to that. Why? Because we know what real people are. We don't know what it is to be God. So Jesus was a man of his time, saw the world as the members of his own tribe and culture and time. So if anybody's discombobulated at the prospect of the people outside knocking on the door and God saying, who are you? I don't even know where you came from. Don't worry about it. Is not yours to be concerned with, or mine. It's God's problem, and I'm quite happy to let God handle it.